Welcome to Took Talk, a video podcast by the band Took, and brought to you by Black Frog Media. We chat with the best in the music industry from yesterday and today, with a focus on the good old days of Canadian rock. This episode originally streamed live on Tuesday, May 11th, 2021 on Facebook Live. Now, here are your hosts, Todd, Brent, Shane, Corey, and Darren.
6:30 in the land!
Corey, that's a great intro. That's all you. We have to give Corey credit. He is not only a fantastic songwriter and producer, but when you come up with something cool and catchy, you need to be cheered for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Cheers. Toast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Toast. We'll have to play that live. We'll have to play the Took Talk theme at our next gig.
A 5-minute version of it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's happening? Nobody else got the memo.
It's the Triumph Rush. It's a threesome today.
It's a threesome.
We should, just acknowledge that. What's going on here? Todd and Shane are off busy doing other things, cool things. Todd said he may or may not be able to pop in today, but needless to say, we have a great show planned. So, what have you guys been up to?
I've been running, I've been camping, I've been watching Schitt's Creek. We just got on that binge. What an epic show! Have you seen it?
I'm round two already.
Yeah. My wife's watched it like 9 times back to front, but I catch a show every now and then. So,
right.
But it's kind of been one of those things that I pop in and out of. But it's a little dry for my liking. I'm not gonna lie to you. But
we actually started it a long time ago and went to like the first or second episode. And we're like, I'm not really feeling this. And then of course it got all the awards and we thought, well, maybe we should give it another try. And you kind of have to go into it it's just, their acting is so epic. Like every single character has their own little thing, from, Alexis and her, she's,
you do that pretty good. Yeah.
We've been practicing.
Yeah. No, yeah, the characters, you can't deny. It's fantastic.
Eugene Levy, just his eyebrows. He must have his eyebrows insured with Lloyd's of London or something. It's just like, what would he do without them?
I just slapped great hair on his face. Him and David, his son, Dan.
Totally.
You almost can't call them their real names. Like,
I know. That's why I said to my wife, I said, can they do anything else after this? Because now that's their character. You wouldn't want to see them in anything else.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of characters that have gone on to do other things too. I mean, Eugene Levy, of course. I mean, but yeah, is this his last one for sure? But I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess time will tell. So funny story about that girl that plays Alexis. Apparently she went into that show kind of one of those, luck, as you have it stories, $5 in her pocket, no gig, kind of just actress trying to make it, and stumbled upon that gig, and the rest is history. So I mean, I guess good things come of it, even
she
if it is
knocked it out of the park. Unbelievable.
And a lot of the other the cast members that round out the show are mostly Canadian as well too.
John Hemphill, he was an SCTV way back when. He's Bob in Schitt's Creek. Right.
Yep. And who's the dude that plays the mayor there? What's his name?
Chris Elliott.
Yeah, he's had like tons of roles, right?
I mean, he's not the guy under the stairs. But... wasn't he on David Letterman or something? Wasn't he the guy under the stairs?
Yeah.
His best role, I think, is when he was in Scary Movie there, whatever. He was the guy with the, the take my strong hand,
He's so good.
Oh yeah,
like, he killed that one. Also, they could do spin-offs on any one of those characters.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Well, and speaking of good songs there, that was the one, the Alexis, A Little Bit Alexis, when she does that song. Have you ever seen that one?
No.
Oh, yeah, you'll get to that one. That's pretty hilarious. She has her own song, because I guess it's kind of a spinoff, like with the rich families. She kind of did the, the Paris Hilton thing, she did her own song, and the lyrics are hilarious.
That's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, I'm just drawing a blank. The actor that plays David's boyfriend and then husband is a great Canadian singer too and actor.
Is he? No way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually performed. Yeah. I think at the wedding scene there, wasn't it, when he actually played and sang?
Good. Yeah, it's good.
Well, and he was in the their version of Cabaret or whatever, right? So
right,
that was pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They're just all great.
And so then you know that Dan Levy's sister is actually the waitress. His real life sister is the waitress.
Twyla?
Yeah.
No way.
Yes.
Oh my God. Okay. That's hilarious.
Now that you know that, just go back and watch it. And you know, so she didn't end up playing herself as a real sister. She ended up playing the waitress instead.
Oh, that's Dan's sister.
In real life.
No way. Okay. That's so cool.
Tight-knit family.
I've gone through it, I think, twice now. And it's because I went through it once with Chrissy early on during the pandemic, like last year. And then when I was up in Canada and I was, you know, visiting with my parents and taking care of them, I just by chance had Netflix or something on. I go, hey, Mom and Dad, you should check out this show. And I thought, no way would my parents in their late 70s and early 80s be down with this. And literally, they were hooked. They watched 5 episodes in a row. And it's all about, like you said, the characters and how everyone, like my mom was like, oh, I think she's great. And I, you know, like she had opinions right away on all the characters. And there you go. Like a show that worked for my parents. And then, you know, all the young kids like it too. So
totally. And the script for Moira, like all those big words she uses. It's like, how do they come up with this stuff?
Your outfits.
You know, does this have to be a drawn out peregrination? Or, you know, I had to look that one up actually. I've looked up a few of them.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. So it's great. Yeah, it is a great show. I guess it's
a good show. And if you stumble onto the, you know, the syndicated reruns, you're good for watching it for half an hour because it's lighthearted and it's, you know, it's fun. It's hilarious.
It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
speaking of all things great Canadian, I guess Todd is not here today, but we have to give him a shout out for happy anniversary.
It is his anniversary today.
So I mean,
wow.
Mm-hmm. And a belated happy Mother's Day to all the moms that are not only involved in the Tube Talk family, but all the moms watching and that tune in every week. Happy belated Mother's Day. Hope you guys had a great weekend. Did you guys do anything special over the weekend?
No.
Well, go ahead.
Other than wishing our moms a happy Mother's Day. I'm guessing, Darren, you actually got to do Mother's Day stuff as a married guy with kids.
Oh, my wife turns it into like the slave day. Like, I mean, it's like literally up until like 11:59, you know, it's like, hey, you got to do this. It's Mother's Day. You got to do this. It's Mother's Day. So it's like, I dread that day more than anything. I mean, you know, I'd rather just do but you know, I guess it is. So now I get a month to plan what I want for Father's Day. So
good. Mm. Get your payback.
Exactly. So,
I was there, Darren, when you first met Lynn, pretty close. That's how long I've known you.
You've known us both individually prior to us even getting together. So yeah, absolutely. You were there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Long time ago. That would have been around 94, I think. Yeah.
Darren had really, really, really blonde, long hair.
Let's see. Show us the picture.
Picture, Darren.
I think we've talked about this. I think we had a picture up before. I don't keep it handy.
You need to see it again.
You need to see it. Brian's here. Brian's here.
Yeah. Yeah. I see him. Oh, yeah. Okay. There we dodged a bullet on that one. All right.
Yeah.
So yeah, we do have a great show. And, speaking of great Canadians and speaking of great hair, Brent, why don't you do the intro and let's bring our guest on. We can keep talking about all the cool things.
A fellow Canadian club circuit warrior from back in the 80s and a British Columbia native, spent some time in Los Angeles. Actually, I need to ask him about where he's residing right now, but I've ran into our guest several times in different cities in LA and Vegas, and he's always moving and shaking, producing. But I want to ask him because first time I saw Brian Howes, our guest, was in Winnipeg at the Zoo back in the day where we all used to play. But since then, he has gone on and wrote some of the biggest songs. Probably we could say one of Canada's biggest songwriters in the last 20 years.
Totally. So
this guy's huge. Very happy to... Oh, yeah. And it won
makes
many
me feel
awards.
Like such a chump when I see his credit list.
It's amazing. So let's talk about it. So, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Brian Howes.
Yeah,
hey, Brian. Guys. Oh, man, that was... I'm a Zoom guy, and I've never used...
StreamYard
platform before, so I timed it. Okay, I got enough time. You have to download Google Chrome to get in. I'm like, oh god, how do I do that? I don't have
see, Darren, I knew that because we almost have to tell people it doesn't like Safari.
So, So I figured it out. I was like, and heard you guys talking. Well, it looks like no one's gonna show up. Like, no, I'm here.
We do this anyway. We yap for a few minutes together and then
got it. Okay,
yes,
yeah.
Perfect. We always do a preamble.
Thanks. Where are you right now, Brian?
Guys, good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Hey, been a long time since we've seen each other, right?
I think last time was in Las Vegas, and we were at some event at the Palms.
Oh,
does this
wow.
ring a bell?
Yeah. Oh,
I might have been with Corey. I might have been with your brother.
Yeah, it was.
I might have been with Kevin and Brian. You were there, and it was something.
Hinder record release party.
My wife just chimed in. She goes, "We were at the Playboy Suite. What was it, sweetie?"
Hinder record release party. The number two.
Hinder record release party. There you go.
Because I was partners with the Maloof brothers, and because they really wanted to, they loved the band and wanted to be partners with me. Because I at the time I had a label with Interscope, and they really wanted to get into the music game, and they offered so many perks and stuff. I was like, "Absolutely, come on, let's have some fun." And then they had this crazy party in the basketball suite.
That was it. There you go. Now, I think I've seen you since then, though. You were producer of the year 2007, correct, at the Junos?
Yeah, 7 and then 2013, I think, or 12.
Yeah, a whole bunch. Yeah, but amazing. I remember the first one. I was in Saskatoon at the Junos.
That's right. It was. But you're from Winnipeg, right? You guys are all from Winnipeg, aren't you?
No,
Corey's not
Moose
all.
Jaw. I'm from Moose Jaw.
Moose Jaw.
Yep.
Oh, I know your brother very well.
Okay.
In fact, been chatting with him a ton lately about because I guess you know he's been thinking about making the Great Escape too as well.
That's right. So you used to live down here and then you moved back up to. Are you on the island now or in Vancouver?
I'm on the island. I grew up here actually and lived in LA for 8 years. It was awesome. I loved it, but I have two young kids. And there was so many school shootings at the time in Los Angeles. And, you know, and they were doing like crazy, like active shooter drills in elementary school. And, you know, being a hoser from the island, I'm like, this is weird, man. Like, I love hockey fights. I love fighting in hockey. But then, you know, you punch someone in the head and then you hug it out after. But the gun thing just freaks me out. So we literally moved back because of that. And then I kept my studio in LA. So I was commuting down 10 days a month.
Wow.
And which is, it's not too crazy from here. It's like 2.5 hour flight. So it was pretty awesome. So I had the best of both worlds. So I moved back to the Comox Valley where I grew up. And then when COVID hit, I couldn't get over the border. So I've just spent the last year building this crazy studio here with Ron Obvious, who's one of the best studio builders in the world. Retire 20 minutes from me in Fannie Bay, and I begged him to come out of retirement and literally just finished my studio a couple months ago.
Wow.
So a lot of changes.
Wow. My wife always talks about moving to the island. Would you say that's a good idea?
Your brother just asked me this exact question about a month and a half ago, and dude, I love it. I absolutely love it. And you know, when I first moved here, I was like, you know, especially with the COVID thing, are people going to want to come here and record? You know who just moved here?
Who?
Who's not even Canadian? Michael Beinhorn. Michael Beinhorn, one of the greatest rock producers in the history of the world.
Wow.
Just moved to Victoria.
Wow.
And then of course your brother, an awesome rock producer, is thinking about coming up, and it's crazy. And Zach Galifianakis just moved here, which is crazy. And James Cameron bought the winery next door to me here.
Oh.
So it's exploding.
It's the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife always talks about Victoria, and she used to live there as a little girl. So,
oh wow,
you know, and we kind of feel the same down here in LA, being Canadian and stuff, and all the crazy things that happen down here, and
yeah,
crazy things happen in Canada too. I mean, the whole population of Canada is the population of LA.
That's so right.
Yeah. Yep. You put that all in perspective.
No,
my perfect scenario is living down here in the winter, there in the summer. That would be amazing.
That's, you know, that's what we used to do, because we have a place in Vancouver, and so I would work, you know, in LA, and then right when the hot weather kind of gets nasty from July, we would come up to Vancouver, and I would take the summer off, and we would just chill in Vancouver. And but, you know, I'm kind of glad that when all this craziness went down over the last year, that I was up here. But I do miss, like, I love LA. I love the weather. I love the healthy lifestyle. I love mm-hmm. There's so many talented people in such a small area. Like Kenny Arnoff was my, we lived a couple blocks up, and I had my studio on my property there. And I would be like, hey, Kenny, you know, last minute I'd go, can you come down and just do a session for me? No problem. He just walked down. It was awesome. And my next door neighbor was Kyle from Matchbox 20. It's like, hey buddy, you want to come play some guitar? Yeah. It was pretty awesome. I do miss that.
Yeah. I think I would miss it too. I mean, it's always the grass is always greener, right? Like, it's like, oh, I wish I was back in Canada. And you get up to Canada. Oh, I wish I was back in sunny LA. And
yeah,
there's no real perfect place, but you can try to make the most of all the places. That's what I think.
No, absolutely. and my kids, you know, they love it up here. My little guy's a big hockey player. So, you know, down there, when he was like 2 years old, I tried to take him to get skating lessons. And they were like, you can't take a 2 year old to get skating lessons. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, he's already over age for Canadians. Like,
he's a late bloomer down here.
He's a late bloomer. So they kind of laughed at me. And up here, he was behind. So, like, but he just loves it. He loves the whole culture and, you know, you with your buddies and that kind of yeah. stuff. So, but
yeah, where did Canada, you live down here? Canada, I think they scout you at about 3 or 4 years old. So, yeah
you're. Oh, big time. They have your whole future planned.
Yeah.
I actually lived in Studio City. I was in Laurel Canyon.
So where did you play hockey when you were here? Was it in Burbank?
Yeah, Burbank, and then the LA Kings ice rink in North Hollywood. But in
Panorama, you know, City.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Panorama City. My buddy owns the place. So I would play ice there. And what's really crazy is I met a bunch of Canadians that were, you know, transplanted there playing ball hockey. And we formed this group, and then we started playing more and more serious tournaments. And then right before COVID hit, we went to the North American Championships and we won the
B. Wow.
And from there, I got scouted by, because I'm a dual citizen, I got scouted by Team USA, and I was supposed to go to a camp to play for Team USA in the world. So I like have this whole other life as a professional ball hockey player.
What was it, on rollerblades?
Wow. No, running.
Are you serious?
Yeah, like old school street hockey.
Oh my God.
And up in Canada, it's, you know, you do it kind of on the weekends with your buddies, but in the U.S., it's this huge sport, and they're thinking of making it an Olympic sport.
That's amazing. I need to get more info on that, because that sounds like something I'd get right into down here.
Oh, dude. Well, when I come down, I'll definitely – we got to exchange numbers, because you got to come up, because we have a pickup game, and it's amazing. It's really good.
That's so awesome. It's a deal.
It keeps the chub off when I'm in the studio.
Right? Yeah, totally.
I was going to say, it's a whole other thing, yeah, because the ball hockey versus ice hockey, I mean, there's no stride, you know, glide. It's, you're always moving. So, yeah, you're basically, your cardio's got to be tip-top, yeah.
Yeah, the cardio is insane. Yeah, there's no gliding whatsoever. But, yeah, and it's fun, too. Like, when we went to this North Americans, and I'm not the youngest guy on the block, I'm playing again, and then I realized that it's like semi-pro teams that are sponsored, and I looked at these, and they were, I with this one team, they're called the Pittsburgh Gods. I'd say the age group is 16 to 22 of fully jacked young dudes, and I'm in my 50s, and I'm like, and there's hitting, and we don't wear a lot. Wow. I wear gloves, shin pads, maybe some like pants and stuff. And I'm like, thank God I'm fast, because I don't want to get smoked into the boards with one of these young dudes, but it sure keeps you young playing with them and competing with them. It's pretty awesome.
Wow. Yeah. So some people are commenting saying, isn't it called field hockey? But no, this is completely different, right? This is basically played in an arena without the ice surface.
Exactly.
Yeah, so yeah, there. So it's a it's a whole other kind of take on the game for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, Americans call it deck hockey, and it's basically exactly like ice hockey, except you're running and you use an orange hard ball, and then you have a floating blue line. But it's the same. You have four lines, and there's, you know, they have the World Championships in Czech Republic. That's where it was supposed to be, and a lot of NHL players play it. The tournament that I was at, Malcolm Subban was there. Alex Burrows is like in the Ball Hockey Hall of Fame. He's like this, the Gretzky of ball hockey. And so, yeah, it's pretty trippy, man. You know, because in Canada we play ice and then you play with your buddies and have some beers on the weekends. But down there it's a serious thing. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, that orange ball is a street hockey goalie's worst nightmare. Like, yes. You know, as a Canadian, you remember those things would freeze and they would just be the death of you if you got hit with that thing. Yeah.
And you learn to put a hook on it. And those things are rock hard, too, man. You can smoke those things.
Yeah, you had three choices for street hockey. You had the sponge puck, right? The tennis ball or that red ball. And that red ball got chosen last every time because it hurt so much when you got hit.
We always went tennis ball, unless it
tennis
got
ball.
Wet. Tennis
exactly.
ball was what was the go-to in the morning before school.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I can remember... My band DDT, it was like 1998. We were signed to Elektra. We were making our first record at Sunset Sound, and we were in Studio Two. And in Studio One, Sugar Ray was making a record, and I remember introducing them to street hockey. And Mark McGrath went in goal, and he didn't have a cup. And I took a cannon and hit him straight in the nuts, and he couldn't sing for 2 days. And the producer, I think it was David Kahan, was so pissed at me. Oh my God. He goes, I can't believe you do this. I'm supposed to do a vocal today and now he can't sing. He's doubled over. He's got a ruptured testicle. And
oh my God.
Yeah, it was
the crazy. Canadian handshake.
Yeah. right in the Sugar Rays. We've been sitting here talking for 22 minutes about hockey and street hockey. And I guess we should, you know, maybe take a look. I mean, most people come on, I would have to go down, you know, or to a rock and, you know, hard rock cafe or whatever and sit in front of a wall like that. But you've got it all behind you. So we're going to get into a little bit of your history here. But just joining us now, live from his busy schedule, Mr. Todd Kearns is going to join us here too.
So. Oh my God. How's my quality? I have no idea.
Pretty good.
Enough.
You're good. Oh, good.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm just chilling up here in the Comox Valley on Vancouver Island. Just kind of, we've been talking hockey for the past 20 minutes, you know, it just oozes out of Canadians. It's so weird.
Yeah, I know.
I just heard about Mark McGrath's broken prostate.
Yeah, David Kahan was pretty pissed at me for that one.
Oh my God.
But, you know, he was a gamer, man. He put on the pads and we just didn't have a jock. And I just took a cannon and hit him square in the nads.
Welcome to Canada.
Who doesn't wear a
jock? I have a quick hockey story. When we were in, when I toured with Vince Neil, I don't know, around 2002, Tesla was also touring with us. And those guys one day showed up with all these, you know, sticks and gloves. And it was like Jeff Keith, the singer, and everybody. And I thought, wait a minute, you guys are from Sacramento. What do you, how do you love hockey? And they were like, no, man, we're totally into it. Sorry, my dogs are barking. And so we just said, okay, look, let's set everybody up on the tour. So I think we made a phone call and one of the companies like Mission Hockey or something was like, all right, we'll set everybody up with roller blades, gloves, sticks. So by the time we were like five shows in, there might have been another band, maybe it was Skid Row or somebody, but anyway, there was all these dudes that shouldn't be on rollerblades and shouldn't be playing hockey running around the venues, you know, playing a dangerous sport. And some of the guys had never been on rollerblades and it was nuts. But what was great was, I'll never forget, so Vince Neil one day was like, dude, let's play in the back parking lot. We were at like New Hampshire at the whatever ballroom there. And awesome. All we did was we kind of did the ball hockey thing. Like you, Brian, yeah, you know, just like had a ball and nets. And I'll never forget Vince came out there, but he was holding it like a golf club. He was holding it like this, swatting at people. And I was like, fail.
Oh, no, no. God. Like he had his hands close together and he swung.
Yeah, he wasn't quite, you know, in hockey mode. And apparently he skated but when he was younger. But anyway, it was a moment I was like, well, there's the golfer who's never played hockey before that picked up the hockey stick.
No,
yeah,
kidding.
It was kind of dumb. And I think I like, you know, snapped a wrist on that tour. Like, you know, I was out for almost one show just being dumb. You know, like we have to really be careful as musicians playing these dangerous sports. And Corey and I are known to have laced up for like the Juno Cup. You should do that, Brian.
Next time I'm in for sure. Cause I was a goalie. I actually played junior hockey as a goalie back in.
Oh, then you're on.
Oh, wow.
You're in.
Yeah. Hey,
if you're friends with Jim Cuddy, he will have you on and you know, you're already on the team.
Oh man, I'd love to. That would be so. You know what the problem is? I've been asked a couple times, but I love the Juno because I love reconnecting with friends, and I partake in too many pops, and the problem is I'm never in good shape to like. I'm usually pretty sauced by the time the Juno Cup comes along, and I'm like, I'm probably going to get really hurt here.
You just got to do the goalie like they did in Mighty Ducks. They're just tie up to the net, you know. Just sit there,
yeah. That's a great idea, but no, I love that. At least, hey, we'll give Vince credit for at least trying, right?
Totally,
exactly. Exactly.
Well, or give Vince credit. Maybe he did his homework and realized that lacrosse was the national sport, so he came out swinging like this, right, Brent?
There you go.
Are we reverting back to the fact that I'm never going to live down.
We're always going to take shots. Yeah.
Yeah. That's an inside
joke. We do here.
Okay. So, Brian,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Corey. Go ahead.
I was going to say the first time I ever saw your face, ever.
First time ever I saw your face.
Was in some bar's green room or the dressing room, and it was a Young Gun poster.
Oh my God.
And I told you, I kind of forgot about it, but then I think we have the picture,
did
right?
It look like this?
Yes.
Oh yeah, baby.
Is that the singer for Trickster?
It all came back.
Oh my God. Yeah. And you know, it's funny. My hair is actually longer now. And when I do it, thank God I still have it all. It still looks the same. And I remember shaving it. Yeah, and Todd and me, I go way back because we were in like competing bands, but we loved to party together back in the day, and we had sure a lot of fun back then. You know, the Metro and California Dreamin', and the problem was I didn't know how to write songs back then, and Age of Electric was writing really good songs at the time, and I'm like, God, I gotta get my game together here and learn how to write songs. So I remember going on tour and I was just obsessed with, I wanted to be an original band, but the rest of my band was happy, like just partying, going to see strippers and getting shit faced. And I was like in the hotel room ripping apart hit songs going, I got to figure out what makes this a hit and why this melody's catchy against this chord. And so I just went to school. And then I remember seeing you guys and Aphrodisiac Smile. I'm like, God, that's a good song. Such a good song. And so you guys were ahead of everybody in the songwriting department, man. I remember that back in the day.
I think you won, Brian. You won that.
I'm gonna say going through your credit list. Yeah, you definitely caught up.
Yeah, you really figured it out.
It's funny, Todd. Back in the day when this was going on, there were thousands and thousands of bands doing the cover scene back then. And not a lot of us survived and are continuing to do because, you know, like you, I've never had a job before. I started playing in a cover band at age 16 and I don't know how to do anything else. I know how to play hockey, grow dope and play music.
Hey, which, you know, dope pays a lot more than the music business.
That was a trailer park joke, by the way.
Actually, you got to watch the Sasquatch movie on Netflix. It's not about Sasquatch as much as it is about growing dope.
I love it.
You should be interested in that. Watch. I think it's called Sasquatch. Yeah, so check it out.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's great.
So Young Gun. Yeah, that was a fun time, and I remember. It was 19. We were just starting to showcase for US labels, and it was like 1990. And we did a showcase at Coconut Teasers. You remember that place?
Oh yeah. Down on Sunset.
And there was a band that opened for us. And a friend of mine just showed me the poster the other day, and the band was Nirvana.
Wow.
Wow.
No shit.
Never heard of them.
There was no one in the crowd. And I saw these guys and I went, oh crap, this is pretty damn cool. What I'm doing is kind of lame. Huh. And then I remember a few months later, Teen Spirit got released. It was like 91. And I heard it on the radio and literally changed my life. I went, I'm done. I shaved my head. I got into punk rock culture. I got into like Operation Ivy, Fugazi. I just, cause I just like, I realized what I'm doing was lame, you know, it just run its course and I wanted something fresh. And that music just inspired me so much and literally changed my life. It changed my life. Wow. And that's when I realized I'm better off being a producer because I like too many different genres of music. Mm. I'm screwed as an artist because I liked everything. I had my punk friends. I had my butt rock friends. And then I had, you know, I like country music too. And then I discovered hip hop and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. So
yeah.
Well, give yourself credit for DDT. Cause I think you guys were a little ahead of a curve too at that
totally.
Time.
Oh, way
ahead.
Totally.
Dude, it was, I loved what we did and we didn't, you know, we were mixing every genre you could ever imagine together. And it was so fun and so exciting and doing the live shows and that it was so good for my production career because I can draw from so many different styles. It's yeah. like, you know, punk rock guitar mixed with hip hop beats with the melodies of Def Leppard or something, you know, it's just, it's really cool.
For people watching that aren't familiar, we have a clip here.
That's my purple hair. Oh my God. Old school.
With the drummer from Young Gun, by the way.
Yeah, Bobby James, my brother.
Great drummer.
So is yeah. that, what would be the timeline on that? What year?
That was before we got signed. That was, we were with an independent label out of Quebec called Shake the Record Label. And yeah. that would have been about, because we started in 91, 92. And then we I think that was 96, 95, 96, something like that. It took us that long to kind of get going and start writing some songs. And then we got signed in 98. Lars Ulrich from Metallica, of course, started a label through Elektra Records, and we were the yep. first signing to that label. And that was a trip. So basically Lars, because I was the business guy in the band, took me under his wing and taught me about the music industry. Hmm. I kind of moved in with him in his apartment in New York with him and Skylar. And he would take me into Elektra Records and go, here's what the promo department does. Here's what this does. It was literally like college with Lars. And cool. and yeah, it was crazy. I learned so much off him and, you know, we're still great friends to this day. But the problem is we didn't have any hit songs. Now I know that. We just had a vibe and cool parts. But I wasn't quite at the level where I could put it all together then.
We have to talk about the song Hey Steve.
Ah, yes.
Because obviously you're a $6 Million Man fan. Is that true?
Absolutely. I was a huge fan of that show. And I remember when we did that song, I wanted that sample so bad. And I remember the publishing company had to clear it. It cost us 10 grand to use that sample.
That was my next question.
It was 10 grand to clear that sample. And wow. You know, that was a big learning experience because I remember Bob Rock and both Bruce Fairbairn wanted to produce our record. And of course, me being from the 80s, I'm like, oh my God, we got to use, you know, Bob Rock's my idol. And of course, the two punk guys in the band were like, are you kidding me? They're so cheesy. We can't use them. So we settled on Matt Wallace because we both like Faith No More.
Right. So sure.
Right. on him and we made a record in LA and it was a great experience. But at the time, Matt Wallace was buying a house and had to be away from the studio a lot. So that's how I became a producer, was trial by fire, because we were all sitting around paying $2,000 a day for Sunset Sound. And nobody knew what we were doing. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll figure this out. And that's kind of how I became a producer.
Wow, that's wow. incredible.
So let's go back a little bit to where you said you're trying to figure out a songwriting process back in the day. And obviously you managed to figure that out. And fast forward to, like you said, seeing bands like Nirvana and seeing how things were changing. And then all of a sudden you're writing a song with Chris Cornell. What was that like?
The whole process of just learning, I, you know, it kind of started after DDT had run its course. I remember we were on the Kid Rock tour, and we had a kind of a medium-sized alternative hit in the U.S., so we were middle slot on the Kid Rock tour. And what was so great about having Lars, it was Lars would just go, who do you want to go on tour with? How about, and Bonte Da Ba was like huge and the record was blown up. I'm like, Kid Rock. He goes, no problem. Then he calls him. Next thing you know, we're like middle slot on tour. It was so awesome.
Wow.
Because he would promise them some Metallica dates if they put us on tour. So it was during that tour, and we had a hit. So, you know, people knew who we were. And I really realized, I was like, you know what? I just wasn't happy. And we're middle slot playing Coliseums with a kind of medium sized hit. I'm like, I just wasn't happy. It wasn't melodic enough for me. I don't know what it was. I couldn't put my finger on it. And now I know, obviously, I was just meant to be a record producer and songwriter. I love it. I do miss playing live, but I love working in so many different genres and that kind of thing. So basically, I quit DDT after that tour cycle and stuff, and then wanted to be a producer. So, but I had no money. I was broke. I didn't know what I was doing. So I got together with Joey Moy, who's an amazing producer now. You know, he's crushing it in the country world. And I had heard some stuff he'd done. He was just kind of starting with Nickelback and stuff like that. And I said, hey, I want to pay you to produce a 4-song demo for me to try and get a publishing deal. So we did that. And the problem is, I had no band or anything. I just wanted a pub deal. I sent it out, and they sent it out. And then all of a sudden, I had a bidding war from all the U.S. majors on this thing. And it wasn't anything. And I said, you know what? What the hell? I'm just going to go out go out in a blaze of glory. I'm going to throw a band together. I'm going to sign the deal who gives me the most money up front. I'm going to split the money evenly with the guys and tell them, look, we're going to make a record. I'm going to party my way through the record. We're going to go on tour. I'm going to bail and become a producer. And that's kind of what we did. We set up shop at the Armory for 4 months. I don't remember a lot of those days. And Joey was eating hash cookies every day. We just freaking we just had the time of our lives, made an okay record, and then I bailed and became a producer.
And that's Closure, right? The band Closure.
Closure.
With Robin Diaz on drums. A good friend of mine.
Robin Diaz, my brother from another mother. Man. We're still good to this day.
So was the name of that band, was that kind of foreshadowing? Yeah, yeah. Well, okay.
I remember doing it. So they wanted me to showcase, but I didn't have a band. And that's when Kevin Zarouk, Chief, introduced me to Robin, and I said, hey, you want to be in a band? I'll give you a bunch of money that I'm about to get. No problem. So we threw a band together, and then I went around and did acoustic showcases between New York and L.A., and then I made up a story about how my bass player is in jail. That's why we can't showcase. And we only had 3 songs because that's all the songs I did. So I remember being at Island Def Jam and go, do you have any more songs? And I literally just on the spot made up a song and mumbled lyrics. And I remember the A&R guy going, that's a hit. That's a hit song. We're making an offer.
Wow.
I have that CD. I'm going to look.
Oh, it's and if you listen to my voice, it's literally like so bad because I was drinking about a 26er a day back then just for fun.
Just for fun, yeah.
I wanted to go out in a blaze of glory, Todd. I was like, this is my last hurrah. I'm going to play rock star. And then I got to get serious about my production career. And then Joey and I became production partners after that. And then we just went, I worked out of Chad's studio in Abbotsford. So Chad Nickelback would go on the road, and then Joey and I just started recording bands together, and we just studied and producing. And then Hinder was a fan of Closure and obviously a fan of Nickelback in theory. So Hinder came to us, and we did a few songs with them, and Joey wasn't really into them, but I thought the singer was a rock star. I'm like, I don't know, man. There's something about this guy. He's like a young Steven Tyler. And I remember when they came to us, they were super boring dudes. They all had super short hair and they shoegazers. And they go, hey, man, we just want to be like Nickelback in theory, man. We just want to kind of do our thing. And I'm like, no, we're going 80s. We're going Motley Crue, Aerosmith. You know, get rid of the Paul Reed Smiths. Get some Les Pauls. Drop them down to your knees. Grow your hair. I'm going to turn you guys into rock stars. And literally, that's kind of what I did.
Yeah, so Brian, I was on that tour. I saw what you did because I was in theory at the time. Those kids, they came out swinging like Motley Crue. And I was like, holy shit, these guys are just like, and well, regardless of the shenanigans, there was good songs backing up all that. And that was because you guys had, you know, you put the time in on all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Big time. We went to the
Southern Angel. What a great song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was and that's the thing too. Like the singer had an amazing voice with that raspy kind of tone, and he was a really good songwriter. And then him and I just had this kind of chemistry together on writing songs. And that song was basically written. He was literally on the phone with his girlfriend fighting with her. And as he's saying the lyrics in the verse, I'm writing them down what he's saying. And that's basically the conversation. And then we went to Whistler, rented a condo in the bush, and wrote the rest of the record up there. And we wrote it in one night, wrote the chorus to it. And then there was a couple girls up there, and when we were kind of demoing it, they started crying, and I knew we had something pretty special when that happened. It was crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, that went on to become quite the hit for sure.
It really did.
Oh, huge song. Yeah.
And in typical 80s band fashion, I guess they couldn't keep it together. Are you still working with them separately, or are you still kind of involved at any capacity with that band?
Well, the God's honest truth is I love the guys, and the problem is the musicianship just wasn't up to 80s standard, you know what I mean? So the stuff we did in the studio, I played a lot of guitar on that stuff. I did a lot of the solos and stuff, and you know, you got it. When you go on tour, it's got to sound as good. You know, like in the 80s, you know, whether you like it or not, a lot of those dudes can play their asses off, man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And shred, and I think it just imploded. I think they took it too far, and the partying got out of control. And I remember when we did the second record, it was really hard to get, you know, everyone's at this point. We'd sold the record did 4 million for a debut band, which is crazy. And,
wow.
And it was a number one pop song, let alone rock song. So everyone got rich, and that's the problem, right? Nobody wants to work. And it was a cluster, man. Cluster making the second record. And then that's when I bailed after the
second
record.
I feel so bad for those guys.
Yeah, exactly, you know, right?
Millionaires, you know.
Yeah, but I don't know about now, but you know, we had the best time. It was such an awesome time. It was exciting because, you know, that was my first thing as a producer by myself was Hinder and Headley were my first two records, was the first Headley record and Hinder record. And then the third one was Skillet. So it was like, wow, this is fun.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So was it your idea to bring Mick Mars in then on that Hinder record?
It was probably all Chief and I are huge 80s fans, and Chief was the manager at the time. And we wanted to, you know, the label was so excited about this 80s thing that we kind of brought back. They wanted us to even go more in the 80s thing. So we got Mick to play a solo, and that was a whole, oh man, what an awesome dude. Like, we went up to his house in Malibu, and this house literally has no furniture in it except plaques everywhere and Marshall cabs everywhere, like 30 Marshall cabs stacked up. And then he's got this TV with Marshall cabs as his sound system for the TV. No furniture, and he's got this beautiful Swedish girl. I guess it was his girlfriend at the time taking care of him. And, you know, he's got this that I think it's scoliosis or
something like that, you know.
And so we went in his studio, and we got the track, and he picked up his guitar, and it was such a trip, man. And then we just had a few cocktails and crank, and he goes, you want to play through my rig? I'm like, yes. So I plug into this wall of Marshalls, and it was just so rock and roll, man. I loved every minute of it. And he was the nicest guy in the world. It was a great experience.
Oh, that's amazing.
Insane.
Yeah. It was so cool. And
How did you get hooked up with the Skillet project?
So the Skillet project, Andy Karp, who was their A&R guy at Atlantic Records, was, believe it or not, a huge Headley fan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he liked the melodicism. And they had signed this Christian band who was on Word, and they wanted somebody to transition them from the Christian world into the mainstream world. And Hinder was just starting to blow up at the time, so he put me together with John Cooper from Skillet, and we just hit it off. Because Cooper's a huge 80s fan. He loves Leopard and AC/DC and Priest and Maiden. So we bonded all over that stuff. And then I really came up with it. Like, together we were putting our heads together because they wanted to, you know, make a straight, you know, worship kind of Christian record. And I proposed why don't we do, like, it could be about God or a girl for people that don't believe. So it's still has your values in it, but for people that don't believe, or people who are, you know, a different religion, it could be about a girl. And he was open to that idea. And that's when we did Comatose together. So I went to Chicago for 4 months and basically just went to school and diving in on every lyric, every word, every part. And yeah, we made that record in Chicago, and it was a great experience, man. It was so fun making that record. I just love those guys. They're so talented. And talk about great musicians, man. They're unreal. Unreal. Yeah.
And the girl back on drums, she's the co-singer, right?
Yep. Amazing singer.
Yeah.
Yep.
She's such a cool sound to have the juxtaposition of his big beefy voice, and then she comes in.
Yep, exactly. And at the time, because this was 2006, they didn't like females at active rock. Huh. It was kind of like, oh, it's very male dominated, and we had like string kind of stuff going on and track stuff. So we didn't get a lot of love at radio with that stuff. But then they couldn't ignore it because the sales were doing so well, and literally it was so tough to get that played at active rock because they had, you know, they didn't want to play the Christian stuff. They didn't like the female backing vocals or lead vocals in spots, mm-hmm. and also the orchestra stuff. It was very rigid, you know what I mean? It's like at that time, mm-hmm. Which has opened up a lot now. It's a wholly different thing now, but it was really fun because we just wanted to make a really diverse record and do something different. And Andy Karp allowed me to do that, which was really cool. It was really
awesome.
Fun.
And
What about Hailstorm? Have you worked with Lizzie?
Yeah, the first time I met Lizzie was when she just signed with her deal with Atlantic, she flew to Vancouver, and then Steve-O from Atlantic, a Shinedown a song that they had done acoustically. So it was just an acoustic and a vocal, and he wanted me to have Lizzie guest on it. And I said, well, why don't we build a whole thing around this? Because they were on tour and they couldn't do it. So he sent me an acoustic with no click with a vocal on it. So I tempo mapped it. We did some drums and built a track. And then him and Lizzie did like a duet on it. And cool. It was a single back in 2007 and did really well. And it was really cool hearing their voices together. But I had no band members. So I kind of had to do everything myself. It was really, really interesting and a good challenge too, especially with no, you know, the click kind of moving like this. I had to tempo map it. But Lizzie was like brand new signed, and she's so awesome. Like we've remained really good friends after that. And I've written some songs for them and had a song on their first record called, what was it called again? Better Sorry Than Safe. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember.
Yeah. I remember. You can't even remember the names.
It's especially now, like with the Zoom stuff, I've been writing so much lately because I don't have to travel now. It's crazy. I can't even keep up, which is good. You want
to
say?
I wanted to circle back to that because we kind of you know, strayed off the path there. But I was actually curious to know about the actual writing process with Chris Cornell. You guys did that. Was that because of the Daughtry stuff and the Idol stuff that you got involved with that? You know, you guys did the David Cook song, the winner, the American Idol song you guys co-wrote together?
No, well, the Cornell thing came about. So I ended up doing a label deal with Jimmy Iovine, and I had my own record company with Jimmy, and he kind of wanted me to run the rock stuff at Interscope, which was amazing. I learned so much off him, another level on the record company side. So basically Jimmy said, hey, do you want to write with Chris Cornell? And I'm like, yes. I know he doesn't co-write a lot. I don't even know if he co-wrote before that. And then, so I came in with the kind of chorus melody and the title Light On. And I kind of just mumbled it. I went, oh, I think this might be good. I don't know how Chris is going to be with me bringing something in. So we hooked up and I played it for him and he loved it and it was cool. And then he just started writing down these verse lyrics, and you know, it's like Chris Cornell's melodies are next level. So the fact that he actually liked my melodies was pretty awesome. Yeah. So we finished the song together and then we recorded it. And you know, it's funny you mentioned that too. I have the demo version with him singing on it, and I'm trying to get, I'm hoping Vicky releases it because I want the world. I'm going to actually send it to you guys because I want the world to hear. I've been sitting on this since 2009 or 10, and it's magic. Like, wow. I'm telling you, he did two passes, and the version we have of his, I had amazing session guys, and we had, you know, I think Kenny played drums on it, and No, Robin Diaz played drums. Sorry, Robin Diaz played drums. And it was just one of those magical times. We spent a week at Henson doing this demo because my whole plan was, and Soundgarden wasn't together at the time. I wanted to do this song and then kind of go, hey, what do you think about getting the guys together? And we all worked. I was trying to get them together and then hopefully maybe I could produce it, right? That was my, and it was working that way. But at the time, Chris wanted to explore his pop side, and that's when he did the record with Timbaland, the pop record.
Right.
And so the song became available, and I didn't even know David Cook. I didn't even know who David Cook was. I got a call from Pete Gamberg at Atlantic going, hey, I got your next single. Congratulations. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, the American Idol winner is cutting Light On. And I'm like, Light On? What? I didn't even know. And I was happy about it, obviously, but I was hoping that Chris would do it and with Soundgarden. It would be a Soundgarden song because the demo I did was very like punk rockish. I used the same kind of tone as Black Hole Sun for some of the verses, which I'll email it to you guys. You guys need to hear this.
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, and just his voice and what he's singing about is so prophetic. It's like, especially with what happened. But we became really good friends after that. And man, that experience is probably my top three of all time in the music business, was working with him, having him sing, because in my opinion, might be the best rock singer in the last 20 years, in my opinion. You know,
He's up there for sure, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how that happened. And then, because I was doing a ton of Idol stuff at the time, they used to call me the Idol Whisperer because they would always send me in first, because when the Idols would come off the show, they would all be like, hey, man, we want to make like a Fugazi kind of record meets Radiohead. And I'd be like, okay, well, we got to kind of milk that, because right now soccer moms love you guys and soccer moms aren't going to get Fugazi. So I was the guy who would talk some sense into them and to try and, you know, keep their vision, but have something that the soccer moms would love, you know? So
sure,
they would get in first, and yeah, it was an interesting time for sure.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Amazing.
And a lot of great songs came of it. Yeah. It's interesting to hear the stories behind them for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and Brian, are you like, if you come into a session, I'm always a firm believer, like, when Desmond Child has, you know, spoken about when he's going to write with somebody, you know, his first experiences with, you know, John Bon Jovi was he came in with a hook line,
right?
Possibly just the having the, you know, you give love a bad name, like a word situation, and then maybe some melody ideas, but not necessarily a whole song, but something to catch you from, you know, as far as the chorus goes. Is that where you're always usually thinking from that 80s, you know, ideas as well?
Well, it's funny because basically my two idols in the world are Max Martin and Mutt Lange. Mutt Lange, AC/DC, Back in Black. AC/DC is my favorite band of all time. Back in Black is my favorite record of all time. I think it's the perfect rock record. Every note, every lyric, everything is perfect in it. And basically, so I've always tried to model myself after Mutt, where every section has a hook, everything is well thought out, everything serves the chorus. You have to build the story like this. So with Light On, it's funny because I was actually tracking guitars for the second Hinder record when I thought of this idea, and then I just started playing it and told them to roll tape, and I just started mumbling, I don't need a light on when I'm gone. Like, I just started mumbling that. I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. And then the melody came from me, and then it was Chris who took that and kind of made the concept. So I don't know where it comes from, but I just start mumbling stuff, and then stuff that sounds really cool to me, and then I'll take some of those cool titles and then try and do the concept after. And like the Max Martin Swedish School of Songwriting, which I love, always
serve
the melody, serve the melody. And you know, obviously in country music and hip hop, it's the other way around, but in pop, rock, that kind of stuff, it's always about the melody. A hooky melody is everything. And as long as you have two or three really good lines to latch onto for people to sing to, then that, you know, obviously you want to try and make every line special, but serve the melody with the lyrics. That's kind of Swedish math.
And you, Corey, you know better than anybody here about, you know, Mutt Lange.
Oh,
and you've worked with him and you've played all the songs for so many years. I mean,
yeah,
you know it better than
anybody. I've been in a Mott Lang cover band for quite a few years.
I love it, man.
I should say that because, you know, Shania gets the equal credit in that. Mott always said that his favorite songwriter was her, you know,
wow,
over all the years of stuff he's ever done.
That's it, eh? That's amazing. And what's really cool is, so I produced the Nickelback record Here Now, which was after the one that he did. And I remember, you know, Chad knows that I'm like a Mutt Lang groupie, and I've never met him. And I've always wanted to meet him. Like, I'm just like a little total groupie for the guy. I just want to meet him. You know, when you meet your idol, you just, and so he, Chad sent him the record that I did, and he said, yeah, this is really good. And I was like, yes. Thank God. I couldn't sleep for 2 days while he had the record. I'm like, oh God, what do you think? It sucks. What do you think? It sucks. But it was pretty cool, man. And, you know, just everything he does, and, you know, just everything's so well thought out, and like those, the way he does backing vocals and stuff. And I usually sing a lot of harmonies on the records I do, and I stack them like he does. And it just adds layers and layers of depth, which makes the song always interesting to hear for the thousandth time, right? You're hearing new production ideas, right?
Here you go, Brian. You need to check this record out. Corey, Tight you know what room. This is?
No.
All right. If you're a fan of Mutt Lang, you better go find this record. There's very early, right, Corey?
Oh,
very early
God.
Produced Mutt Lang band. Are they South African? I don't even know.
Oh,
South African. That's
right. They're South African. That was the first.
Tycoon. Yep.
Wow.
He wasn't in that band, though.
No, he was the producer. Produced it. Yeah. I just happened to be listening to it like yesterday, and here we are talking about Mutt, and I'm like, oh my God.
Does it sound good? I bet it sounds awesome.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Yeah, that's so
I'm amazing. I'm in vinyl mode lately. I'm just going backwards and listening to good records. As you can see, they're all here. But, of course, right. You can go through any AC/DC or, you know, of course, those Def Leppard records keep coming back. And you just, like, you're always going to learn something new every time you hear Hysteria or something, right? It's just incredible.
Oh, exactly. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, too, because my manager is really good friends with Def Leppard's manager. And I said to him, I said, dude, I would love to produce the next Leppard record. So fingers crossed, we'll see what happens. So I'm going to Joe, I think, cool. Coming up here. I would just be awesome. And, you know, it's full circle, right? I grew up on that stuff. And that's kind of what got me interested in production was those records were just like, oh my God, what's he doing here? Why does this sound so big and full? And it's crazy, right?
They're amazing dudes too. They're really good guys.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice guys. You guys know, you probably toured with them. You know, it's funny. The Leppard guys, they're all still together. They all seem to be still friends, and they all look really good.
Yeah.
It's a good care of themselves, right? And they still sound amazing.
Yeah.
Singing their harmonies live, you know, like they all sing. It's just, it's funny. Hey, like all of us guys from the touring club days in the 80s, but you know, there was a certain template that we all liked bands that sang and all played their instruments well. And, you know, I think that template still works. That's what Max Martin is all about. That's all those great songs he's written. It's coming from those 80s bands, you know, like it clearly has that you always can go back to the well.
That's the thing. When I work with a band or artist and they tell me they used to be in a cover band, I get really excited because I'm like, oh, you know how to play. You're going to know how to play. You know, and you'll know how to sing harmonies. And I get really excited because I think that's the best thing you can do is like play hit songs while you're learning to sing, you know, sing and play at the same time. And you're playing hit songs. So you're getting used to what that sounds like.
Yeah.
It's definitely been the secret to our success as musicians, having been a part of the 80s when we played every single night and played all kinds of different music and had to learn how to emulate singing styles and guitar parts and effects and all that kind of stuff. I think that really was a huge benefit to us, you know, to put us where we are today.
Well, and speaking of Took, man, you guys are off the chain good. Like, God knows this. Remember, I was reaching out to you. I'm like, because I love Canadian classic rock. I love Streetheart, Queen City Kids. I grew up listening to that stuff. I absolutely love it. And you guys do it better than anybody, man.
Thank you, Brian.
Because we love it so much too. You know, we put our labor of love was doing those two records that we did.
And that stuff's not easy to sing, Todd. You crush those vocals, man. Like those singers sing high.
Trust me.
Right?
We put Todd on all the female, you know, hey, Todd, come on, sing Toronto and Darby Mills. And it's like,
yeah, I know.
Ed Lannis was great.
And he's up for anything. He'll never complain.
Yeah, we just take them all back and fire those rock hard hockey balls at him. And, you
know. No kidding, eh? Help with the hot notes.
Yeah. As soon as he takes a couple to the nads, then he's ready to go.
That's we have to give Corey credit because Corey is our producer as well. So the records that if you hear what you're hearing is also, you know, put together and Corey's attention to detail. And again, like yourself, it's all about what we learned in the 80s, you know, making good stuff sound, right, Corey?
Oh, absolutely. It was so fun to try and, especially the synth sounds, to try and emulate the synth parts and the sounds and trying to figure out what they used back then and actually reaching out, which is what I did to Alex from the Queen City Kids. I'm like,
oh, nice.
For the Down Again keyboard solo, what did you use? And he was able to tell me exactly. So I was,
because I was like, you're nailing this because I know all those sounds, all those songs. Great job, dude. Well, you Churcos are so talented.
Thank you.
Just going through the vault here, where they're always looking for new Canadian classic rock to cover. What about this one, guys?
You know any hair flips? I think it's like 800 hair flips.
Lots of hair flips.
Oh, that's a great song.
That's amazing. Great song. Do you still have that guitar? You still have that guitar?
No, the Kramers are gone. You know what's funny? I literally just found an old picture of me when I got my first guitar, and it was like I think my parents got me a 72 Fender Tele, and at the time I was bummed out because I wanted a Hamer, and I was so bummed out, and I'm like kicking myself now because that thing probably worth 20 grand. But I'm a Les Paul Fender Tele ES335 guy. Like nice. I fell in love with all those kind of guitars, and I haven't looked back. And I have a very special Fender Telecaster that actually used to belong to Prince. It's like a 73. With the black knobs on it, and on the back it's got Prince Band Corpse, like with the serial number. And I bought it at Guitar Center, and my friend at Guitar Center held it for me, and yeah, it's magic.
Wow.
I bet.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty sick.
My dad had an ES335 and he traded it for a PVT60.
Do they still have the PV as well?
No. No, I don't think so. That was a sad day. That was a sad day.
Yeah,
poor Peavy, eh? Poor Peavy. They always got a bad rap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was their first guitar kind of out of the gate. And somehow the guy at the music store talked my dad into, this is the latest, you know, it's where everything's moving, Peavy, you know. So he sells this precious Gibson or trades it in on this Peavy.
Guitar for?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I think I had a reverse headstock Kramer with a whammy on it, with a Floyd Rose. And, you know, I was more of the Angus solo guy. And then my guitar player, Brett, was the sweep guy, the Ingvae.
Oh, yeah.
I could never do
those. Those are good days.
Magical days for sure. Yeah.
And
I guess I got to go, you guys.
Todd.
I got to go back to work. But I love you guys. Great to see you, Brian.
Great to see you too, Todd. Awesome, buddy.
Hey, man. Let's
Todd's
talk.
Pulling, this, Todd's pulling.
Hey, happy anniversary, Todd.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Happy anniversary.
Let's talk offline, and we'll actually talk about the real stuff, not all this fake shit you guys are talking about. Actually. Love you.
Tell your boss. Sorry for keeping you.
Well, awesome. I'm glad he's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. What the hell's he doing anyway? Oh, I think he's playing music.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Down at the buried
Sarah in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a lot of music, probably more than I do. And I'm you know, I've been lucky because I get to play guitar and sing harmonies in the studio, and it keeps my chops up. But I've been doing a lot of country stuff lately. My first country song, that's one kind of music I always liked, but I never did a lot of it. And my friend goes, "Hey, do you want to do a song with Keith Urban?" And I'm like, "Yes."
Huh. Amazing.
Did?
So I did a song with him, and we geeked out over Def Leppard and the Beastie Boys, and made a really cool song, and hopefully coming out on his next record. And from there, I was like, wow, I really like this. So I'm kind of jumping into the country world a little bit and having some fun, man.
You could probably shed some light on this too, though, because I've always made the assumption that Keith Urban, I mean, as great as he is and as great as he is doing what he does now, he's a rocker. There's no way he didn't grow up as a rocker. I mean, for sure, right?
Huge Def Leppard fan, huge Mutt Lang fan, amazing guitar player, and the nicest human being I've ever met in my life, like literally. And so talented, and yeah, that was a great experience. So great, great way to break my country cherry, as they say. You know, and I just met so many cool people down there, and just so I've been doing quite a lot of country lately, and realizing, wow, these guys, everyone's good down there. Everyone is.
Yes.
Like,
they're players for sure.
Oh yeah, like, you know, it's funny. There was a time when I was recording bands, and a lot of bands couldn't really play, so I ended up playing all the guitars and stuff, but now with the country guys, I'm like, man, I'll gladly pull myself out. You know, it's just kind of nice kicking back and pulling out the good performances, you know?
Yeah. You almost won't survive in Nashville if you're not a player, because everybody's so good there.
Everyone's so good.
And that gets weeded out pretty quick.
Yep. Yeah. You got to be smoking to be one of the guys that gets a lot of work, you know?
Yeah.
And, okay. So how about, I'm digging on Eric Etheridge.
Eric Etheridge. Yes.
Great. Really so great.
That was your latest country project that you worked on?
No, that's probably I haven't been doing country that long, probably 3 years. Eric is right after Keith Urban, actually. A Canadian guy, a friend of mine, a great manager from Canada who lives in Nashville now, Jordan Elliott, introduced me to Eric. And we just started writing together and started recording together. And he was indie, and we ended up with a couple gold records independently, which is amazing. Hmm. And he eventually got signed to Anthem Records, which used to be Olay, which where he's at now. Yeah. We just kind of learned together and wrote some good songs together. And it's funny, the first single, I actually got the title from Trailer Park Boys saying, and it was, you know, Ricky, tonight the liquor's calling the shots. And I went, freaking country too. And we wrote Liquor's Calling the Shots.
That's awesome.
Great country title though, right?
Now you owe somebody some money.
Thank God you can't copyright titles.
That's really great. Are there any rules these days in Nashville? Because it seems like Nashville songs or country songs are just pop songs with a country singer.
Well, here's what I've kind of learned, and I'm definitely a rookie in the country world, and I'm just keep my mouth shut and my ears wide open. I learn as much as I can because I didn't grow up with that culture. I grew up, you know, Iron Maiden, Priest, AC/DC, Motorhead. Those are the bands that I grew up on. So one thing I've learned, like, especially when you're working with a Canadian, if you don't have the accent, you know, because you need to, if you don't have that natural accent, you really have to make it really country, you know, because Canadians, we have a closer accent, like, hey, bud, yeah. Beret, you know, that kind of thing. It's not quite like the Southern accent in the U.S. Right. So when Americans from the South do it, you can have more leverage with the production. Mm-hmm. You know, like with Morgan Wallen, which is Joey's doing, he, you know, Wasting on You, he's got trap beats in that, which is genius. Yeah. And you can get away with that because...
And you do too with the Eric stuff, don't you?
I did some track stuff, but I didn't do trap beats with him just because I thought it was too far. But we have to make sure that we got our pedal steel in there and some of the country roots. And I'm kind of learning as we're going what elements you need. And it was a learning experience on the Keith thing too, because he really wanted to like have a track like the Beastie Boys and that kind of stuff. So there's definitely some certain rules that, you know, not really rules, kind of anything goes, but being a Canadian and trying to break down there is really tough because we don't naturally have that accent and stuff. So you got to be cognizant of, you know, not having the distorted guitars too loud, unless you're Eric Church where you can crank them and you have that twang. So I'm still learning, man. I'm a rookie in the country world. I'm just trying to make great songs and then listen as much as I can to people who really know what they're doing in that world.
Yeah. I remember Terry Clark, Canadian country singer. Mm-hmm. She, well, you know, she got an accent as soon as she got a deal.
Really?
Serious. I was like, where is she from? Alberta?
Yeah.
She sounded like she's from Nashville. So,
I've heard that a couple of times. I it's funny. When I was singing background vocals on the Keith song I did, I was putting on a fake, just as a joke, putting on a fake accent in there. And then I did a straight one, and then I got him to pick which one he liked better. And he picked the one with me faking the accent. And I have a really bad fake accent, by the way. But I guess if you live in Nashville long enough, maybe you'll pick up a little bit.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. A lot of my friends have, you know, picked up a little bit.
Totally. You know?
And I guess that's what happened to Madonna when she went to London.
Yeah, I remember that.
But now she lives like just a couple miles away from me. So we'll see if her accent changes again. She's in LA now.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting.
Yeah. She's in Hidden Hills. She bought like whose house did she? The Weeknd's. She bought the Weeknd's mansion.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Where did he move to?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah, you never know. Nashville's a great town. You know what? It's funny. I think the reason I like country music is when I go to Nashville, it reminds me of growing up in small town Canada. It's very Hoserville.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And people are so nice. You know, you work really hard and then you go out and have drinks after. It's like, I like the culture a lot. It's really cool. And people down there are so talented and so nice. So I'm having a lot of fun in the country world right now. It's really good.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. But now we need to talk about important things.
Okay.
Tell us about Pamela Anderson.
So yeah, she's from the Comox Valley, of course. And when I was in my basement at 17 years old, jamming Def Leppard and Street Hard and all that cuff, she was there with her friend watching it.
Amazing.
Yep. She used to come over to my house. My parents were the parents that allowed us to jam in the basement, and she would come over and watch us jam and stuff. But no, she was an awesome girl, and it's crazy how big she blew up. It's
totally.
It's pretty nuts. But yeah, hometown girl, man. And she was absolutely drop dead gorgeous back then. Absolutely. And
do you remember the Labatt's Blue poster with her on it?
I do.
Yep. Brown hair. She just looked like country girl.
BC Lions.
That's right.
Yeah.
Wait, so she wasn't she at a game, or what's the backstory real quick, that she was sort of like spotted in the crowd
or something, right? Was it?
They showed her on the Jumbotron or whatever, and I guess somebody that worked for Playboy saw that, and the rest is history, and then, you know, she became
amazing.
Big star. Big
wow. And like you said, then she blew up and became famous as well. So, yeah.
And you know, she just moved back. Yeah. Blew up.
Nice.
She just moved back to the island, by the way, like a year ago.
Oh, really?
Yep.
She's back there too.
She just married again and lives in Ladysmith, I believe.
Amazing. Wow. So that is the place to be then. It's settled.
Come. We got Michael Beinhorn. Your bro's going to be here. I'm going to be here. Garth's here. Garth Richardson, another great producer. So we're going to turn the Vancouver Island into this little musical production zone, you know? It's going to be awesome. Yeah,
and Ryan Dahl. Do you know Ryan from Age of Electric?
He's
on one of the little islands there, Main Island or something like that, I think.
That's right. I saw the pictures on Facebook. It looks beautiful over there.
He's got a nice place, yeah.
Oh, Jim Balance. He's been on one of those islands forever too, right?
I don't know where Jim lives, actually. Another great guy. I got lucky and wrote a song with him when I was a young gun. I don't know how
Wow.
That was another pivotal point in my career, was writing with an amazing songwriter like him. I learned so much off that process.
Did you guys work at Little Mountain too? Because you were a Vancouver band, so to speak. Or where did that Young Gun stuff get recorded?
Little Mountain. They spec'd us. They spec'd us an album there, the Levins Brothers, which was awesome, and never forgot that.
Bruce Levins?
Bruce and Roger Levins.
Amazing. Yeah. he did for us too, with my brother and I, our band, The Explorers. And Todd was recording Age of Electric there at the time too.
Yep.
With Bob Rock in the another room.
Yep. I remember that. That's totally right. Yeah. Those guys were really good. And yeah, it was Little Mountain. But and fast forward, most of my outboard gear for my studio is from Studio B in Little Mountain. I have all the
need. No way.
Yeah. I ended up buying that off the Levins, and that's in my place here now in Courtney.
So all the stuff that you had down here that you said you're commuting to, is it now up there, or do you need me to look after it here?
I shipped it all up, and you know, it's funny. I've never been a techie guy, so I've always aligned myself with really great engineers, because I wanted to be more like the Bruce Fairbairn kind. I know what I want to hear in my head. I just, you know, I know the basics. But since Ron Obvious, who's, you know, one of the best studio builders in the world, he built Mutt Studio in Switzerland, you know, and the Little Mountain Warehouse Armory, he built this. He's been teaching me all the tech side, and I'm loving it. But the problem is, now I'm so invested. It's like, okay, now I need a 421. I just bought a Pultec. I'm like, I can't have any clones. I need the real stuff, because the best stuff. So it's like it's a hit to the pocketbook, but I'm actually really having fun on the tech side and really enjoying learning all about how compressors really work and all this. So he's my Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, for sure. What a gift to be around somebody like that and ask questions. And
oh, dude, it's amazing. And I think he's having fun getting back in the game again, because, you know, I think he was kind of semi-retired, just, you know, putting little speakers in churches and stuff. And then I came, and then ever since I did this room, because I'm just going all out, like I'm building the sickest studio here ever. And then Garth saw that, and then Garth got Ron to come over and tweak his room. And then your bro, I hooked him up with Ron, so he's going to get that set up for him. And then I hooked him up with Michael Beinhorn, and then the drummer from Tears for Fears just moved to Victoria and wants to put a studio in. So now Ron's like booked for the whole year.
Amazing.
I mean, retired, yeah. So what's the plan now going forward? You got this great studio. Obviously, COVID's kind of probably, you know, kind of put a damper on what you can do. What's the plan moving forward? Anything on the horizon?
You know what? This has been honestly my busiest year in 13 years. So I have two teams in LA that I work with, like engineering teams. So I've been Zoom producing with them as I'm recording my Canadian stuff here. Hmm. So I've been literally doing three productions at the same time, and it's been working out great. I just did a song with Adelita's Way. They just went into Sunset Sound with Jason, who did all the Rise Against stuff. Amazing engineer. And it's been working out awesome. So, you know, I've tried to make lemonade out of the lemons that we've been given over the last year, and having a blast. I'm having like the most fun I've ever had. I've got new teams of people that I'm working with, and I'm having fun like I first did when I first got into biz, man. I'm having a blast making music again. I'm just loving it.
So do you find that do you think that that's something that you could continue doing, or is that something like now that might open up other avenues? I mean, now that you've kind of done the online production, is that something that you think could be done, or is that, you know, is it really more of a, you got to be there in the headspace sort of thing?
I think for some of that stuff, and especially on the writing side, like sometimes, like with Chris Daughtry, I never produced any of those records. I was just a writer, and Howard Benson did all those records. So for writing, like with Europeans and people in Sweden and stuff, it's amazing. I think that'll keep going, because people can do more without all the crazy travel. So, you know, I think it'll be a little bit of each, you know, like a little bit of travel, a little bit of regional work, and then still Zoom producing and Zoom writing. I think it's opened up a whole new avenue, and I'm just, it's just fun again. I not that it was never not fun, but now I'm like, it's like when I first started, I just have that buzz again and a bunch of really cool releases coming out, you know, that excitement. Mm. And
And like you said, it must be good too, obviously from a family perspective. I mean, you can do your job and still be at home. Right. So, I mean,
Yeah. And that's what the beauty of the LA place was. You know, I love that place so much. Like I had a slice of heaven. I had like, I had a half an acre in Laurel Canyon. So when you come in, but it's surrounded by trees and fruit trees. So as soon as you're in, it's like you're in Canada, but you're like 10 minutes from Hollywood. So it was a slice of heaven down there, but it was just, you know, it was just getting out of hand with the kids. Like my daughter came home once and said she was super scared because they were doing active shooter drills. And then literally, as I was thinking about selling and moving the family back, I had a 8-time convicted rapist climb my fence and run into my house to hide from the cops.
Oh,
the SWAT team came in with their guns pulled. It was crazy. And that was the nail in the coffin. I told my wife, go to Vancouver Island to find us a house. We're out of here. And this is in Studio City, right?
Yeah. Well, when we first moved to LA, one of our first experiences, we went to a movie. It was that crappy Steven Spielberg movie, AI.
Yep.
And it was packed, and these kids were just laughing and farting and making all these stupid noises during the show. And I, you know, turned around and told them, or my wife did, she turned around and said, you know, keep it down, you guys, you know, kind of gave them a reprimanding. And then, I guess one of the kids leaned over and said, fucking bitch. And then sure enough, they were waiting for us. There was a whole gang of them dispersed throughout the theater. Were waiting for us outside the theater after. Luckily, we had our vehicle from Canada with the remote start. So we had it started by the time we got in and we took off, but they chased us all the way back to our apartment building. right down into our underground parking. Luckily, there was an exit going out the back, and the gate was already open, and we snuck out there, went to a grocery store, Ralph's, and called the cops, and they escorted us back.
That's the worst Jedi story I've ever heard.
Let me guess, Universal City?
No, it was right on Van Nuys and Ventura, Van Nuys Boulevard.
Oh, interesting.
There was a theater there, an AMC, or there's a Gelson's there. But anyway, yeah, it was.
Yeah, there used to be a Tower Records down the street and all that. I remember.
Oh, I know where that is. Yep. Yeah.
Exactly.
And, yeah, that's one of the drawbacks. Look, there's so many pluses. I love LA. I love the weather so much. I love the people. I love that everyone, you know, there's so many talented people, like I said before, in concentrated area. But there's, you know, that's the thing with you get something. There's so many people there. Like trying to park at Trader Joe's on Ventura. Have you ever done that? That's a contact sport.
I know. True. Yeah. Yep. Especially around like a holiday season, Thanksgiving or Christmas.
It's and people are swearing at each other.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh my God, this is crazy.
And then they get the parking attendants to, you know, and they actually cause more chaos than, you know, good.
Yep. So it's definitely, and now there's this crazy homeless problem they have in LA. Like, I remember right before we moved, which we've been here 2 years now, we had a homeless lady in my driveway, and she set up her tent and everything. And I wasn't allowed to do it, like move her, because I guess they declared all their stuff as an official domicile. So I had to leave her, and look, she wasn't doing anything, but it's just with my kids, you know, walking and stuff, it just gets a little sketch, you know what I mean? And they need to take care of them somehow. Like, mm-hmm. And it's getting worse and worse. Like when I come back to Studio City, I can't believe all the tent cities now. Like, it was never like that when I moved there in like 2011. It was never like
any overpass. There's always someone underneath it, like a community.
Yeah.
They're working on it, and they're building these little houses.
That's good.
That are actually pretty cool. But I don't know, you know, there are a lot of homeless people, so I don't know how many they can house that way. But they're just being displaced because of all the stuff going on downtown, and they're trying to turn that, you know, gentrify that whole area. And
I can't imagine this pandemic has helped that situation.
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, it's too bad. Yeah, no, so that's basically you know, the reasons why I came up. And but it's, you know, like as soon as I get vaccinated, we're way behind you guys. So I get vaccinated next week, and once the quarantine ends, the first trip I'm making is to LA, because I miss the sun so much. I'm a vitamin D worshiper. So
me too. And that's the only reason why I put up the brakes whenever she says, let's go back to Canada. I'm like, do you remember it was 9 months of not seeing the sun?
That's it. That's the drawback. But, you know, that's what keeps it lush and green.
Oh,
You know, hiking Fryman and stuff, and playing ball hockey with my buddies at 10 at night when it's 23 degrees outside, like, that's paradise for me personally.
It's pros and cons to both places. There's no perfect area, like I said before, but if you can make the best out of both worlds, then that's great.
That's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a condo down in LA, and because I'm going to, you know, all my contacts are down there, and I do mostly American stuff. Mm-hmm. This is the most Canadian stuff I've done since I started, which is kind of awesome. You know, it's always fun trying to take Canadian arts, build them up, and then try and break them down there. You know, that's the challenge.
That's right.
I think it always has been, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. You gotta take a shot, and you know, especially with people that deserve it. Like, I'm working with a guy named actually, it's Patrick Waugh's son, Jonathan Waugh.
Oh, I know Jonathan.
Do you?
Yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, Jonathan, dude, I'm telling you, this guy's voice is next level, world class.
We just
four new songs that I think are mind-blowingly good. His voice is so good. He's such a rock star, and things are really, really starting to pop. We did his first single that we did together. It's got like almost 60 million views on YouTube. Wow. And this is independent with no radio tracker or anything. Like, this is all independent. And now
amazing.
We're getting indie offers now. But with this new batch, I think I can get him a U.S. major. I'm pretty confident. And because he's got all the check marks, he really does.
He does. He's a good looking kid. Yeah. Great voice.
What's
he's got? He's Patrick Waugh's son.
Jonathan Waugh.
Like the goalie? Patrick Waugh, the goalie.
In fact, he was a goalie too. And there's some pretty awesome footage of he's quite the bruiser goalie as well.
You know, everybody like knows the infamous fight that he had, and he played for the Quebec Ramparts for his dad. And but just, you know, he's like a brother to me, man. We just bonded musically and personally, and his dad's such a nice guy. And
I was going to say, as a Canadian goalie, you must have had some great conversations with his dad too. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I first started working with him down in LA, I'm a big, huge Habs fan, and his dad was my idol as a goalie. So when you come into my gate, there's Habs stuff everywhere. So I remember the first time he walked in my gate, he looks around, he goes, you're a Habs fan, eh? And I go, yeah, dude, why do you think you're here?
here's a Sharpie.
But yeah, he's an awesome dude, man, and he's so talented. So that's one I'm really excited about. And I'll share some music with you guys after we're
absolutely.
Oh yeah. That's sick, dude.
Yvonne.
Like Guy Lafleur has always been, and Ken Dryden, because we're about the same age, right? Like,
favorite player. Guys. Yep.
Guy Lafleur.
Favorite player. Yep.
Matt Hair.
You know,
in the cigarette.
Oh, smell the spirits and drink the beer in the dressing room, like the good old days, right?
Right.
Oh, dude.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
I got crap all over my little mantle.
It's not crap. It's amazing. Music shit.
I got to see. That's amazing, the stuff you have in there. I actually got to play goal for the Montreal Canadiens alumni about 4 years ago.
What? Like Marcel Dion playing too? Or
no, it was Steve Shutt, Chris Nyland, Stefan Richer. It was amazing. And so I flew up from LA, and it was the Vancouver Island All-Stars against the Montreal Canadiens alumni. And I played goal for the alumni. And it was the highlight of my life, and you know, being in the dressing room with them, hearing the stories. And I hadn't played goal since junior. So I literally, you know, I was like, oh, I play ball hockey, I'm in really good shape, no problem. I go out, first butterfly, I shred my groin. First butterfly.
Oh, my God.
And here I am. And I'm like, okay, I'm playing for my favorite team. Oh. I'm playing through this. I played through it.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't walk for 6 weeks.
Totally worth it, though, right?
Yeah. I was just high on endorphins. And
what a great story.
Having Stefan Richer go, you're good, kid. You want to come play a couple more games with us when we go on this tour? And I'm like, I can't. I want to, but I can't move. Yeah.
It was so fun. Cool. It's fantastic.
Unbelievable.
Well, the stories have been great. We know we've kept you probably longer than we should have, but it's fantastic catching up with somebody that's done as many great things and has participated in so many cool projects. Stories could go on forever, but yeah, it's been a blast chatting with you.
Thanks, guys.
All the best in you know, the new studio and everything that's coming up. Hopefully once the vaccines roll out in Canada, as well as they have, I guess, in the US. I mean, yeah, like you said, we're still behind. I've yet to get mine.
Aaron's
as well
in Winnipeg, so yeah, he's waiting too.
Oh, you're in Winnipeg.
I'm in Winnipeg, yeah. So yeah, I'm on the waiting list as well. So yeah, we're but just you know, praying for things to get back to normal so everybody can do their thing. And like you said, we can get back out there. And now that the sun's shining a little bit back up in the north here, we can definitely have things to look forward to. So
absolutely.
As always, it's been a blast. Like to thank, you know, our guest Todd for popping in for a couple of minutes, and we'll see everybody next week. And yeah, and it's been a blast chatting with you guys today. So, it's giver time.
I freaking love that. Where'd you get that shirt? That's sick.
My niece gave it to me for Christmas 1 year. Apparently, there's a giver store in BC somewhere.
Yeah, there is.
Where's that? I need to
go. It's like inland somewhere, like Revelstoke-ish or somewhere, or Nelson. I'm not sure. Somewhere in there.
Well, Garth Richards and I are talking about starting a rock label, and we're going to call it Giver Records.
Nice.
I love it.
Thanks, guys. It was awesome. I had a blast. I always love talking about music, and it's great reconnecting with old friends. And definitely will call you for ball hockey.
Yes. It's been a blast, Brian. You know, everybody go check out some of this stuff. I mean, you know, just Google it. It's all over the place. Tons of great, you know, songs, records, bands that you've got your fingerprints all over. So it's been a blast. And yeah, we'll catch up again. I mean, hopefully things will be a little bit easier and maybe do it in person. We'll do a live show, everybody in the same room. That would be a blast.
We've been doing this for over here.
There's a Tuke gig in Vancouver Island area, you know, soon. We get to connect that way.
Oh, dude. Well, maybe I'll throw a show here and bring you guys up.
Yeah.
That would be fun. Because I'm trying to, they have a lot of shows in Courtney, but it's all folk music. I would hire you guys in 2 seconds. You guys are so good.
Let's rock it.
All right, boys. Awesome.
And there you go.
Contact info too, because I want to send you this. I want to send you this song. You got
to
hear it.
I'm gonna reach out to you. Yeah,
and it'd be nice to reconnect and stay in touch with you guys too. Thanks, guys. That was fun.
All right. As always, thanks everybody for tuning in. See you here, same time, same place, and we'll see you guys next. See you next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. Bye, everybody. Right. Thanks, Brian.
See you guys.
Bye, bye.